First of all, I'm so excited to see all of you here. So many of you are, I know, are close friends and sort of family of Frank. So it's exciting to be here among everybody. I want to lead off because I think that there are so many in this room who know some of this work. I want to lead off with talking about the works that are in the show.
Mm-hmm.
This is an exhibition that begins in 1979.
Yes.
And goes all the way to 1996.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, the works, yeah.
Where did you live then? What did you? What were you doing? What's the sort of? What's Frank Bowling up to between 79 and 96?
I was struggling to maintain my studio in New York and re-establishing my situation here in London. And I fell foul of what I thought was a rather decent person, an artist called Graham Nixon. And I was fighting for my studio in New York, which was on Broadway and Spring. And the art scene, the painting scene in during that time was tumultuous. And there were sort of, the color field painting had begun to sort of buckle and become sort of meaningless in terms of what you were looking at, and there was arguments about empty center painting.
What would that have meant? What was empty center painting?
Empty center painting meant that, you know, the middle of the painting, when you look at a work, it was sort of like just empty, so to speak, even though it was filled with paint. But the edge was where, you know, the sort of established distinction of what was a work of distinction. Everyone was looking to the edge. I mean, Jules Olitski, for instance, was painting these fields of sprayed paint with thick acrylic and then drawing the edge of the painting in sort of bright color or sort of subtle colors, and the painting stood as though it was a piece of something that you had to reckon with. And of course, there was a meeting among the artists downtown about where painting was going, and there was a panel that I titled "With a Painting, Where Painting is Going." So there was all this the turmoil about establishing the sheer and pure quality of what we were doing as painters out of color field, and then in came sort of the new painting out of Berlin, Germany, with people sort of revisiting worn out ideas about composition and stuff like that. And, it dawned on me that the way to proceed to make pure painting established and strong and wide enough to accommodate all the talents that were around, the paintings lacked structure and they were falling to bits. So I set about myself to restructure the idea of how you make a picture. And the edge, of course, was important, but also the depth of the field of painting, you know, like it was, it had to be flat so that, you know, the nuances between the surface had to show that it was like up front and flat, and on it went. So during that time, of course, I had a difficult sort of domestic situation. My sons were growing up in London. I needed to see my children. And I tried to hold down a studio in New York and one in London. And it was during that time that I was in London trying to be on the edge and being, you know, in contention with the best that it was. But I was painting alone in London with this sort of, these bodied out structures and, you know, thick paint and the rest of it. And this is during the time which I was making these paintings.
I felt like while Frank was talking, Mel, that your head was bobbing and that you were great. As a critic, when you were looking at that work then, what did it seem like to you? And what was the sort of tenor of painting at that moment in London?
Well, as Frank has said, on the one hand, you had the kind of recrudescence of a kind of expressive, figurative painting coming from Germany and elsewhere. I didn't find that very interesting. And at the same time, a lot of people who'd been painting through the years when painting was supposed to have gone into exile, you know, during the triumph in the 70s of conceptual art and so on, came out again and kind of asserted themselves a bit more. But all that was happening, it seems to be, in a way that was quite a bit distant from what Frank was up to. Frank's response to American painting was always kind of interesting. It still is, and it still goes on.
Yeah.
But when he talked about empty center painting, and you know, with a painting, where was painting going at that time? That kind of thing. A lot of that painting, that kind of abstract painting in New York. I mean, I think it was not just empty at the center. I mean, I think it was just generally empty. And the question as to where it was going, the answer must surely be nowhere. I mean, that was really the problem, Frank.
That was the problem, yes.
And what's interesting for me, in relation to what Frank has been saying, not the only thing, but is that Frank somehow, in spite of the fact that he knew these people, worked with these people, knew what they were doing, in a way that people in this country really didn't, because things were happening in such a way during the mid-70s, late 70s. At the same time as that was happening, Frank was doing his own thing, more or less consistently and entirely coherently through those years. And it seemed to have very little, in many ways, to do with what was going on in, open field, plain colour field. I mean, even Frank was a master of colour field painting, but even then, he wasn't satisfied with it.
No,
you know, when people were making big, beautiful, empty colour field paintings, Frank had to complicate the matters by, using a stencil and putting in maps and, you know, his mother's house. And I mean, it was like, there's always been the sense in which Frank was a free spirit. The other thing to be said about that period in relation to Frank was that, as he's indicated, very briefly kind of adumbrated, it was a time of great stress and tribulation in many ways.
Yes.
Both, do you mean personally?
Personally, okay. Both here and in the States. They were hard times. Quite apart from anything else, he had no money. And nevertheless, in the most cramped circumstances, sometimes some of the biggest paintings he made, wonderful paintings, in fact, which we might mention later, were made in a room that was no bigger than a kitchen. It's a kind of marvel that that happened. So what I feel is that when Frank speaks of these troubles, it shows that, in a way, this kind of free spirit, this extraordinary kind of creativity and refusal to be, got down by these things, it's the triumph of painting, if you like. I mean, he went on doing what he went on doing, and that's something which is going to be that for precise period is what's covered in this exhibition, and what I hope maybe we can talk about a bit more as we go on.
I want to read something that you said, Mel, and I want Frank to tell me what he thinks about this, because I find it really interesting. Mel says in the catalog for Train Gone, the show at the Sprit Museum, he writes, "This painting is less determined, less predictable in its forms and evocations." What does that feel like to you, Frank?
It sounds like he was honing in on how it was all happening, because to me, I had to rise above my circumstances and make works that were the cliche cutting edge. You know, I was very conscious that you know, an awful lot of the stuff that was going down was rubbish. I had to cut through it and try and make it new. And we were overwhelmed by the notion of novelty, so that if you know, the paintings had sort of glitter or something like that, that was emphasized, not the actual sort of piece of work that could stand on its own on the wall and deliver, you know, a sort of satisfactory sort of picture, you know, and a work on a rectangular piece of painted canvas that just simply you couldn't walk by it, you know, that it caught your eye. So I felt that even though modernism has one of its ingredients that is ongoing, the novelty, that the novel is not necessarily to do with beauty or making a work that is, if you like, awesome to look at, and you know, like the feelings you get out of it is sublime. You can't have the sublime. I've been arguing recently over and over again. I just tried to argue then that the work has such power that you can't walk past it. You have to confront it and deal with it. And I felt that what I was trying to do, with the kind of knowledge that I had at the time about geometry and, you know, architecture, you know, I was trying to bring everything in, like church architecture details and, you know, sort of classical buildings and the whole business of the rectangle as a classical sort of piece of something that actually helps us define ourselves in these rooms in which we live, in these boxes. So, you know, I just kept going, trying to cut through all the rubbish and, you know, make work that was kind of new, but wasn't bogged down by the notion of novel. Mm. You know, even though novelty had its place in modernist consideration for assessing, you know, the quality of work.
And yet this is exactly the moment where you introduce things that many people, you know, Mel included, have called novel, like the foam.
Yes,
into
right.
The painting.
Yes, yes. I mean, I found that anything that was sort of plastic, you know, the whole notion of plastic paint, plastic toys, plastic everything, you know, you can make anything out of it. You know, that was one of the reasons why you could actually make a work out of this superior sort of artist material that was plastic paint. And when I started cutting up the foam, I discovered that because of my predilection for sort of using unusual tools like pinky shears, that the serration across the surface had a kind of an echo of the weave of the canvas. At the same time, it made it sort of like operate on the flat rather than the relief. And, you know, that's what I was really sort of digging into and trying to present. And I was here in London and not in New York, where the front line was. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a difficult time in that sense, too.
I'm fascinated about so many things about you, Frank. And I feel like I know lots of things about you personally.
Yes.
Too many, maybe, sometimes. But one of the things that I don't know actually has to do with you and Mel.
Yeah.
In that, so of any other critic and any other writer, period, Mel has worked with you, I would say, for the longest and the most sustained relationship.
Yes, yeah. Well, the nice thing about Mel is that Mel was part of a kind of literary thrust that was happening in new writings from the Irish and English. You know, we had friends who were poets and publishers. And hanging out, the London scene was much more literary in that sense than New York, which is to do with, you know, hustling your game up for producing paintings. Here it was very literary, and my predilection for you know, an early need to be a poet. I used to hang with these literary people, and that I found a sympathetic soul in Merlin.
So you met him because you wanted to be a poet?
I met him because of my longing all the time to be involved in the literary things. You know, the writing.
Well, yes, but I met you because of my longing to be involved in artistic things. We did have friends in common, that's true, but...
Who were your friends in common?
Well, they were writers and poets that went back a long way, and publishers who were publishing, as Frank said, a number of Irish writers at that time, Flann O'Brien, Patrick Kavanagh, and
Kavanagh,
so on.
Yes, only good boys.
So, but the interesting thing is, Frank, that one of our at that time close friends in common actually wrote a review, sought to write it, and wrote it in response to a review I wrote of your Serpentine show, which was the first show of these works that came out of the late 70s, early 80s, which left behind the kind of automatic, determined painting of the, you know, the port paintings that you showed to such brilliant effect in the Tate last year. And that's what I meant partly by more, you know, less determined. They weren't determined by process. They were, of course, determined, but they were determined by decision. By putting things in, by sticking in these bits of gel, these bits of foam. And I have to say, that made a lot of people found that very, very difficult. It made life, in a way, critically difficult, I think, for you.
Because, I mean, our friend said, what's Frank doing eating all this acrylic? Look at the shape of him.
Yeah, the foam. Nobody understood the foam. Nobody understood the gel. But talking to Frank, I began to realize that at that time, I mean, when I hardly knew anything, I began to realize that it was in classic English painting that he was looking for some kind of way out of the impasse you've described. You know, what to do and how to make it, both make it new and somehow make it not empty and make it kind of mean
urgent.
Something.
Yes, urgent.
Grab you when you looked at it. And these paintings did, but they seemed to grab a lot of English critics in quite the wrong place because... you know, they actually, as I said, one of our friends sought to answer. I wrote a good review. A favorable review.
It was good. Well written,
it was good. Yeah. But I wrote a favorable review of the show where these big new paintings were being showcased at the Serpentine. And this friend decided to write a very long critical letter in which he said, these are not paintings at all.
No.
These are something else. You know, what's happened? Frank Bowling was a painter, and now he's something else, and he's made it's kind of nonsense and so on, because there just was not a very favorable critical kind of frame within which the kind of work that Frank was doing, which, you know, was unprecedented. There is nothing like the work of this period.
No,
it's a fantastic period of work, and the show in Sweden is going. I think it's going to be so spectacular for that reason.
I think it's going to display
but
that.
You know, so it was. There was, although we had friends in common, they weren't necessarily that friendly to what Frank was up to, and so it goes.
Yes, it was. Yes, I lost my revolutionary zeal. You know, post-colonial politics and all that, and but I was intent on making competitive pictures, and it's true what Mel has just remarked on, that I suddenly discovered the people I was intent on trying to open up, like Newman and Still and Rothko, had learned something very special from 18th, 19th century English landscape paintings, you know, Constable Turner, people like that, and the Americans had done something that was sort of specific about these attempt to sort of picture the awesome and make it not domesticated, but make it sort of light up your the environments in which you lived. And it twigged on me that being trained and living in London with the Tate Gallery around the corner and the National Gallery, that I was looking at art from that point of view, being, you had to, sort of, when I went to art school, knuckle down and do the drills that you would put through, learning how to draw the figure, organize the space in the canvas and stuff. So all this business of the edge and middle and stuff, I'd taken in without sort of having to dwell on it. It was part of how I was. And the Americans, what they'd done with me painting through from Jackson Pollock forward, we were up for something that was, I don't know, all these cliches I can think of, like the New Frontier. You had to make paintings that were just so specific and full of life, within the disciplines of the material you're working with, like red, yellow, blue and stuff, and all the geometries, that was insisted on by, the Council of Trent and the religious sort of dictates about, pictures must work in a room and stuff like that. We had it, we were drilled to respond to that when you try to make some art, and all the other peripheral things, because of this insistence on novelty and newness, tended to lead the activity into a cul-de-sac.
Yeah.
And I felt, that I suppose in my innocence, that I was in it too, because my good friend Clement Greenberg said, you mustn't hesitate, go for it. There's no avenue of the activity that you're not allowed to activate and make new. So I was if you like, sort of predetermined to go for it. Mm. And the works that I was doing then here in London, which is the way it was all being made, some of it was made in Skowhegan in Maine, places like that.
I forget, Frank, that you... I don't forget this, but I'm reminded to hear you talk about your practice in that way, that you are trained at the Royal College at a time when, yes, essentially you're getting the education of Reynolds.
Distilled down into
a very specific way, but by a 68, that would have absolutely not been the case.
No, not the case, because I was in New York, and in the stream of the, this sort of turmoil of making works that have this capacity to amaze and detach themselves from, almost, but not entirely, from tradition.
I think the thing is, historically speaking, important thing is that Frank had a deeper access, if I can put it that way, a more inward, relationship with British painting, especially with the great classic trio of Gainsborough, Turner, Constable.
Yes.
And that access was not available to American painters in all sorts of ways. I mean, they were aware of it. There was a big Turner show in New York in, I think, 66, which opened a lot of people's eyes, but they opened their eyes because they thought he looked like an abstract expressionist. So you had that. Frank had once he's set himself upon the course of being a painter, had been familiar with this work, mm-hmm. and as you've said quite acutely, was working within a school system within which, you know, which went back to that in a manner of speaking. But on the other hand, being in New York, absolutely in the thick of it, you know, Frank was very, very aware, in a way that most British artists weren't, of what was going on inside American painting, not just what it looked like, but what was happening in terms of the arguments,
the
ideologies, the thoughts and feelings as they were expressed quite often eloquently by the artists themselves at that time. So he had this. Only one other, I think, British artist, you know, had anything like a similar kind of, as it were, grasp of that duality, and that was, well, I was going to say John Hoyland.
Okay.
As an abstract painter.
Yeah. Yeah.
The only other artist, I think, Frank, that had anything like that insight. Mm-hmm. You know, he went to New York as well, more or less at the same time, and so on.
Roughly, yeah.
So you have this grasp of British and therefore European painting, plus this inner knowledge as well of what was going on in New York, which was the kind of cauldron at that particular time. These paintings at this period, both in terms of scale, in terms of ambition, in terms of the desire to activate the surface, the desire to be evocative without being descriptive, all these things, you know, to create an event, which is what you're talking about,
yes,
when you said about, here's the rectangle, what's going on?
Yes.
How do we, you know, and how does that relate to the things that make us what we are?
Yeah.
You know, this is big. These are big demands for any artist to be making on him or herself. And so, you know, there they were, these two sources, and Frank was able to utilize both. So these paintings have scale, they have color, they have, as I said, those things about the surface, they have things about the fact that it,
yes,
you know, it's a flat thing, it's an object on the wall, the what you call it, the foam,
that's
made
right,
that more
yes.
clear. You know, there it is, you can see it's stuck there. Mm-hmm. The facture, the making, is there in front of
yes,
your eyes.
Everything was going on, and the music of the rhythms, the color, and you know, it was all, it was not just painting and
exactly.
sculpture that was happening in New York, but all the jazz musicians were around.
Yes. Coltrane.
Coltrane, and hence, you know, Train Gone, because that was my sort of rather lame attempt to bring together an expression that of disappointment. When you go to, you, especially the people, the poor people in Guyana, going to the train station to sell their wares and stuff, and arrive there, and the expression comes up, Train Gone. And I was thinking of that in terms of John Coltrane, gone, 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 and the music way out there. And, you know, it was this kind of mealy, this mixture that I was trying to sort of get into the center of and be in contention about making works that could stand and deliver within the best, you know, the first order activities that it is painting. You know, there is something about painting that you can always tell that the activity is about a first order activity by the way the artist manipulates the paint, you know, the shape of the thing, you know, the stuff that comes to your eyes and, you know, makes you feel funny and, you know, you're stand back and look again, those sorts of things. Is a whole experience about painting that I was trying to aim at.
It's funny that you mentioned this. Today I went to see the Late Turner Show at the Tate. And at some point, there is a really wonderful card that explains that the paintings that are left unfinished at Turner's death are not titled. And so there are titles that are applied post-mortem. And then it's great because the curator comes back in and says, these are obviously not titles that Turner would have approved of.
No.
So I'm looking at the titles. I mean, the titles that you have in the 60s and the 70s, yes, in many ways seem to speak to the moment of those paintings. Sometimes, yes, they reference the studio.
Yes.
Sometimes they reference the streets in which you live, the people, yes, that you know.
Yes.
But then we get to the 80s and into the 90s, and we have Squashed Unicorn.
Yes,
okay.
Yes, yes.
Fishes, Wishes, and Uncle Jack.
Yes. Yes.
You just tell me. I don't know.
It was me trying to, at the same time, duck the criticism I knew was coming down by trying to get the onlooker of the work to be involved in aspects that I myself are involved in, like, mythological things, from the Greeks to the Romans, and also, you know, sort of Sepik River and the Africans. Everybody have their kinds of, as it were, secret numbers that those in know, but those who are not in know will have to find out about. It was all to do with some kind of...
So there are those of us who will never know.
There are those of us who will never know because, you know, you can't catch it because, you know, the sound goes through the air like an arrow and, you know, tank feet. I mean, tank feet, for instance, is... There is elephantiasis, which is a tropical disease that you get from the water, and your feet swell, and it's probably related to what I am suffering from acutely still. Diabetes, you know, and you see a Bigfoot woman, you know, tank feet, and the name Mazaruni is a river in the abundant rivers in Guyana. So I'm playing with the words as though I was still continuing to be a poet or something like that.
Mm.
It's all, you know, I've been having fun.
Yeah.
So a lot of the, you know, those things are to do with sometimes pathologizing hurts. You know, I named a work called Bradley's Dog, but it was one of the most swift American black painters, African-American painters around town at the time.
Tom Bradley?
Peter Bradley.
Peter Bradley.
A color field painter, you know, and he was really, you know, he was taking glossy pages out of those magazines about, you know, lots of vegetation in the world and sort of trying to, you know, ape these images. And, you know, I knew somehow that that was a cul-de-sac and you couldn't convince Peter that, you know, because he was involved in deluxe, you know, everything had to have, you know, that kind of edge and swank. And, you know, that's not what painting is about. Painting is a very serious kind of thing that, you know, if you can't deal with it, it'll jump on the wall at you.
Mm.
You know, and Bradley's Dog was a title that I deliberately use as a kind of challenge to his... you know, he knew more about jazz and, you know, and things like that. And, you know, he was a swanker. Well, you know, you don't bring him out in the yard and punch him up. You know, you just do it much more swiftly and cut through him, you know, this kind of thing.
You paint him down, is what you're saying.
You get down, right? Yeah.